You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1991 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother George Booker on the subject, The Revelation of Jesus Christ.
We have an especially busy class today. We're going to be looking at a lot of Bible passages. I want to keep it moving along, and I need every minute I can get. On page 18 of your red book, we have a section called The Theme Verse of the Apocalypse. And this, I am suggesting, is chapter 1 and verse 7. Now, an interesting point about chapter 1 and verse 7 is it looks very much like a prophecy. And you think, well, that's not unusual. It's in the book of Revelation. But if you think about those first five chapters of the Apocalypse, it really isn't prophecy. Chapter 1 is an introduction of the Christ figure, and beautiful symbolism there drawn from various places. Chapters 2 and 3 are the letters to the seven ecclesias, or churches, to whom presumably the Apocalypse was first sent. And chapters 4 and 5 are a heavenly vision in which there is given to Jesus the scroll or the book which apparently reveals the future and reveals those who will have part in the future. But basically, it's chapter 6 that we must come to before we get into the body of what we typically would call prophecy. So chapter 1 in verse 7 is very much in this introductory section, and yet it's set apart. And there are several clues that suggest to us that this is a verse that is bracketed or to be highlighted or set apart from the immediate context. And I see it in that situation, in that place, as being a theme verse, sort of like a subheading to tell us what the book of Revelation is about. Let's test that and see if it's true. Revelation chapter 1, verse 7. Look, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the peoples of the earth will mourn because of him. And then we conclude that section, you see, to emphasize the point I was making. So shall it be. Amen. Indications of a very significant verse, set apart, as I said, from other sections of prophecy. Is it, in fact, a theme verse for the book of Revelation? Well, take the first half of the verse. He is coming with clouds and every eye will see him. Well, the first part, even of that, he is coming with clouds. That is a quotation from Daniel chapter 7 and verse 13. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. And we've got the idea of Jesus and God together, and we don't want to get into the details of God manifestation here. We don't have time, and that's not the point. But obviously, the first part of the verse, taken from a distinctive Old Testament verse, is emphasizing that the book of Revelation is about the coming of Christ. Now, the second part of the verse, that's what I'm aiming for, and I think there's a very important lesson here. The second part of the verse is borrowed in large part from Zechariah chapter 12, verses 10 through 14. And we have it there quoted, so we don't have to look it up. As I said, we're going through a number of Bible passages. So we don't have time to dwell on each one particularly, but we need to follow the theme. And that's the way I feel that I have to get this point across. I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication, Zechariah 12 tells us. They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child. They will look upon me whom they have pierced. Now we know that God is using personal language here because in a sense what happens to his son is what God himself is experiencing and feeling. And Jesus is the manifestation or the representative of God. But never mind that. Again, we're talking about the God manifestation idea that we have to leave to the side for the most part. The question is, who would be those who pierced him? In a very broad and general sense, I think it can be said that all of mankind are, in a sense, responsible for the death of Christ. But biblically speaking, and there are numerous examples for this in the Gospels and in the letters, those who pierced Christ were the Jews. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. And even though when we read in the Gospels that the Romans may have driven the very nails into his flesh, the Jews were responsible. Now, Zechariah 12 is telling us this as we read through it. They will look upon me, the one whom they have pierced, and they will mourn as one mourneth for a firstborn son. And in the continuation of that Old Testament context that Revelation 1 and 7 is taken from, on that day, the weeping in Jerusalem will be great, as the weeping for Hadadrimmon and so forth. The land will mourn, each clan by itself, with their wives by themselves. And then the particulars, the clan of the house of David, the clan of the house of Nathan, probably that means the prophet Nathan, but I'm not sure. The clan of the house of Levi, that's obvious. The clan of Shimei, which probably is Simeon, but again, we can't be positive. It might mean Shimei, the person in the time of David. But however we handle a couple of the smaller points there, it's obvious in Zechariah 12, those people who are mourning, those who have pierced him, those who will see him and mourn as a result, are the house of Israel. And so perhaps in this theme verse, Revelation 1, verse 7, it is being suggested to us something about the scope and the context of the book. It's not just about the return of Christ, and that's perfectly obvious, but it's about the return of Christ and the impact, both immediately before and immediately after, that that enormous event will have upon the people of Israel. Zechariah 13, verse 1, which is the next verse after this section, tells us, on that day a fountain will be opened to the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from sin and impurity. So a suggestion here that even at the very beginning, it is quite possible that we're being told the book is particularly about the people and the land of Israel. And others will play a part in that, obviously both as enemies and friends. And surely when the kingdom of God comes, it will affect the whole world. But it begins in Israel, and that's a typical Christadelphian doctrine, and we see it. And we realize it in so many other places, and maybe with a slightly different perspective, we can see it in the book of Revelation as well. Now, just to follow up on that a bit, in chapter 6 and verse 13, in chapter 6, which is the first real prophecy in the book, we have the opening of seven seals. And the question naturally arises, what is the arena in which these seven seals are opened? And it may be difficult to tell. We're going to try to find some reasons here and some evidences to tell us what the arena is. But in chapter 6 and verse 13, just to mention one point, the stars of the sky fell to the earth as the fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by the gale. And then on to chapter 7. And there's an interesting connection between chapter 6 and 7. They both have to do with seals. There are the seals that are opened by which events are revealed, and certain events happen or brought by God upon a particular arena. And then when we come to chapter 7, there are certain people who are being sealed, who are being marked out as special. And in chapter 7, verse 4, I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000 were sealed. I don't know if that's a literal number or a figurative number, but we're told that they're sealed out of every tribe of the sons of Israel. And then very specifically in verses 5 through 8, the various tribes are enumerated. So the seals, apparently, the opening of the seals result in certain individuals being sealed, and particularly at the beginning of this chapter, there is concentration on the tribes of Israel. We come to the last part of chapter 7, and by contrast, we are told in verse 9, I saw a great multitude, which no man can number, contrast with 144,000. They come from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, contrast again with those out of the 12 tribes of Israel. So I'm suggesting that it looks as though there is emphasis upon Israel, and then there is brought into the picture those out of all nations who together with the Jews constitute, obviously, the one body of the redeemed. The chart at the bottom of page 19, I alluded to this earlier, is taken from Brother Norris's book on the Apocalypse, and it summarizes all of the points of contact between Revelation chapter 6, which are the seals, the seven seals, on the one hand, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke's Mount Olivet prophecy on the other. And we're familiar with that, I think, to the extent that we don't need to read it or talk about it particularly, except to realize that the Mount Olivet prophecy had an initial fulfillment having to do with the Jews and their own land originally, and then looks forward to the very last days. And sometimes when we're trying to interpret the Mount Olivet prophecy with regard to the last days, we ponder about some of those passages like, pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath day, because it still sounds like we're dealing with Israel, and we're trying to divide. Is part of it having to do with Israel? Is part of it having to do with the whole world? Or is maybe even the last days context set initially in the land of Israel? So, when we see that Revelation 6 and the Mount Olivet prophecy have many points in comparison, then we go back to our initial verse once again. Revelation 1, verse 7, the repentance of the Jews is what God is seeking as an important step in His process. Many other Old Testament prophecies look to this as well, and it's quite possible that in the New Testament it is a significant theme too. A little point in passing, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have the Mount Olivet prophecy. The Gospel of John does not, unless the book of Revelation incorporates part of the Mount Olivet prophecy and maybe expands upon it to give a fuller picture. Moving on to page 20. And I call your attention to the title. You have to understand we're now entering the third class, and that's why I needed a few extra minutes to talk about that theme verse. And we're now left with about 40 minutes to deal with the third class, and we're still going to have to work pretty fast to get the main points. The title of the third class, the subtitle, is Earth and Heaven. Two very simple words. We probably assume we understand those words. We read the book of Revelation. Earth and heaven occur many times, and perhaps the meaning seems obvious. But maybe it isn't so obvious. John Thomas, for example, following, I think, good biblical precedents that were accepted even by earlier expositors, suggested that in scriptural symbolism, in the interpretation of prophecy, earth quite often would mean the people who were being ruled, and heaven would be those who were exercising authority or rule upon them. There are good biblical reasons for that, many of them. What I'm going to suggest today is something of a subset of that particular point. So it shouldn't be totally unfamiliar to us, but I think it might help us to focus our thinking in the way I would like you to focus it, and I'm offering a suggestion, but to focus our thinking in a way that will help us appreciate this particular perspective. There may be others, but this particular perspective on the book of Revelation. And the subset are the corollary, so to speak, developed out of what John Thomas had to say is this. And I'll tell you up front where we're going so you'll know when we get there, and you'll say, yeah, he told me that, and you'll perhaps see some of the evidence. So where I would like to go is this, that earth and heaven don't just mean ruling powers in general and people who are ruled in general, but more specifically, quite often, in the biblical context, earth and heaven, I should say heaven and earth represent the ruling powers and the ruling places of Israel and those of Israel and around Israel which are being ruled. So I'm saying, take it out of the broader context, put it in the smaller context, and all of a sudden some ideas are going to start developing. Now I told you up front where we're going. Now I'm going to show you, hopefully, some of the reasons why this works. Page 20. The arena of Bible history and prophecy. We start with some of the Abrahamic promises, dear to the heart of all Christadelphians, and we can quote these without too much help, I am sure. A significant aspect of the Abrahamic covenant is the promise of a special land. Genesis 13, the Lord said to Abram when he was departed from Lot, look northward and southward, eastward and westward, all the land that you see, I'm going to give it to you and to your seed for an everlasting possession. What land was that? In general, we know it was the land of Israel. More specifically, the land is defined in certain places. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 18 is a specific definition of the land. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates." Notice the map, the first map, or the top map, on page 20. There is at least one possibility, and we could draw the map in slightly different ways, I realize. We could discuss to some extent whether the river of Egypt is the Nile River or the Wadi El Arish, which is out there in the midst of the Sinai Peninsula. But let's leave aside the smaller points because they don't affect my general presentation. And in fact, whether this land that is darkened here is the true land or whether it extended a bit further to the south, like Brother Sully shows in his book with the cantons of the 12 tribes. Again, I think that is not the primary point. But we understand, generally speaking, the land that we're talking about, the land which is bounded on the south and the west by Egypt, which is bounded on the north and the east generally by Syria and Assyria, if we're using biblical definitions, or Babylon, if we're thinking of a slightly different time. This land, continuing with the text, was, this may be of real consequence to us, a land of 10 people, and therefore, in biblical terms or symbolic prophetic terms, a land of 10 nations or 10 kings. That's Genesis 15. I didn't put those verses down, but you can note them. Genesis 15, verses 19 through 21, and in fact, you can count the 10 peoples. The Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaim, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. It was a land of 10 kings. Don't worry too much about the exact borders. We know, generally speaking, the land that is being referred to. It was within this extended land of promise that much of Bible history was played out in the Old Testament. Remember that summary we did the other day, very brief summary of the Old Testament prophets, and the prophets sort of go in parallel fashion along with the history of the Old Testament, where Israel experienced two major crises in their time as a kingdom. There was the Assyrian invasion, and there was the Babylonian invasion, which put an end to the nation of Israel, the kingdom of Israel, for a while. And those Assyrians and those Babylonians, when they came, they developed allies amongst the people of the land, the immediate neighbors of Israel, who had hated Israel from the very beginning. And once again, those were the peoples immediately surrounding Israel. On to page 21. The 10 nations of Psalm 83. The map is there on page 20, and we're probably familiar with Psalm 83. It's been discussed a good bit in the community in the last little while. Psalm 83, and I'm not going to read that, but Psalm 83 lists, once again, 10 nations who were generally the enemies of Israel at some point, through a long period of time, in Old Testament history. And they are specifically given there in the map on the bottom of page 20. Gebel, Tyre, Ammon, Moab, Edom, and so forth. Text at the top of page 21. The 10 nations of Psalm 83 occupy today the same area generally as the 10 peoples of Genesis 15, 19 through 21. 10 kings or 10 nations that were the enemies of Israel in Old Testament times, that contributed to the overthrow of Israel whenever they had an opportunity. Thus, the extended land of promise is a land, prophetically speaking, peopled by a reborn Israel and 10 kings. Question. Did Jesus refer to this when he prophesied of the coming to life of the fig tree and all the trees? How many times since I was a youngster have I sat and heard discussions of prophecy and people have talked about the blossoming and the blooming forth and the coming to life of the fig tree? And everybody knew it was Israel. 15 Old Testament passages tell us the fig tree is the nation of Israel. How many times did I hear someone say, the fig tree, oh yes, and all the trees? It didn't happen. Basically, in the land that we were just talking about, maps of which we just saw, give me some latitude as to precise borders, I don't know, and I don't think it's that important. Basically, within that land where Israel has come to life once again, almost in our generation, there have been within a period of time, 20 or so years either side of 1948, the birth of 10 other nations. Now, if we extend it a bit further, we might find 11 or 12. I'm not sure that they fit in the same category. I'm not sure that I have exactly the right 10, but allow me a little latitude and let's look at the general picture. These are all nations that came into being as a result of the fall of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. And that opened up the whole of the Middle East, the whole of that land that was promised to Abraham. And in the midst of that land, there came to birth a people and a nation called Israel in 1948, in the red there. In that land as well, there has come to birth in the same generation, in the lifetime of many of us here, 10 other nations. Interesting, and I suppose it's only a coincidence that 5 of them came into existence before 1948 and 5 others since 1948. But there they are. Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Egypt, that was sort of a protectorate, if I remember right, of England, and then it achieved its independence. In fact, England was dominant in this area with some help from France and the U.S. After World War I, the area was divided and subdivided, the peoples were put together, and finally independence came to be granted to these people. Of no great consequence in the affairs of the world until oil was discovered, and now in the last 20 or 30 years becoming increasingly important. Jesus said, "Look for the fig tree and all the trees." Now, anticipating questions, one question that might arise is, but those 10 nations in Psalm 83 are not the same as the 10 nations that are mentioned in Genesis 15, and they aren't. In Psalm 83, a number of those who are mentioned, and you can look at the map on page 20, including Ammon, Moab, and Edom, and the Ishmaelites, the Hagarenes probably, a number of those were either descendants of or relatives, cousins you might say, of Abraham. The nations, on the other hand, mentioned in Genesis 15 were primarily the Canaanite peoples that were already there before Abraham came into the land, and Isaac and Jacob. So here's a family tree, and we can see here how Abraham's family included his broader family, including his descendants and his cousins and his other relatives, included the people of Israel, the Jews, in the red, and the Arab peoples. Arab is a word or a name that in the Hebrew means the mixed or mingled peoples. Moab and Ammon, the Ishmaelites, the sons of Keturah that figure in various prophecies, and Esau, who was called Edom, and from him came the Edomites. So a number of Arab peoples that came into existence and are related to Abraham. This is probably familiar to most of us. Back to the text on page 21. As we said, two different groups of nations. In some way, are they related to one another? And the answer is yes, very much so. The word Arab means mixed or mingled peoples. And these various lines that we just saw on the screen, Edom and Moab and Ammon, obviously were peoples that mixed and mingled with one another. What else did they do? They mixed and mingled themselves with the people who were already in the land, and there are biblical examples of this. Genesis 21, verse 21, the middle of page 21, "And he, Ishmael, dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt." Genesis 26, verses 34 and 35, "And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of another Hittite. And it was a grief of mind unto Isaac and Rebekah, because they undoubtedly had hoped that Esau would be like his brother Jacob, and he would remain a part of this exclusive family who were the people of God. But he went out and mingled himself and his seed with the people of the land. And the mixed and mingled people who are called Arabs today, scattered throughout the Middle East, as distinct from the Jews, are obviously the descendants of Abraham's relatives and the remaining descendants of the Canaanites, of all the various, and I use Canaanite in that broadest sense, of those 10 nations or more that occupied the land of the Middle East. Other instances, I'm reading toward the bottom of page 21, of the word Arab, signifying mixed or mingled, as related to peoples are. And I think these are all the other instances where the word is used as attached to people. And in these five passages, at least four of them are very obvious as referring to Arab peoples. Maybe the one to point out here, or the two to point out, Jeremiah 25 talks about the mingled people that associated with the king of Babylon and were responsible along with him for the overthrow and the destruction of Jerusalem. And they are defined as the people, the Philistines of Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, and Ashdod, and all the kings of Arabia. These were the kings of the mingled people. It's that word, Arab, which is, in our modern speech, Arab. Other passages follow the same pattern, particularly Nehemiah 13, where Nehemiah was distressed because his people were intermarrying with, there they are mentioned, the Ammonites and the Moabites, and they were a part of a mixed multitude. Summary paragraph at the top of page 22. So the mixed people of the Middle East are the Arabs, with blood ties to the original Canaanitish peoples and the corrupted descendants of Abraham. Both these groups of peoples have had historically intense hatred for the children of Israel. Now, with the admixture of a unifying religion, Islam, these Arabs view the Jews as great infidels who have no real claim to the land of Palestine. Interesting also that in the holy book of Islam, the Quran, Ishmael is substituted for Isaac as the one who was to receive the true promises from God. And thus there is a religious reason for the Arabs' hatred of the people of Israel, because they see them as the usurpers in the special blessings that came to Abraham. And we're familiar with this. We see this argued out in the world around us today. Certainly the stage is set for a battle between Israel and the 10 kings of the land. And if that sounds slightly familiar to something that you can read in the book of Revelation, so be it. And as Daniel describes, it is in the days when a mixed and mingled people, represented by the toes of the image, trample down Israel. In those days, he says, the God of heaven will set up an everlasting kingdom. So far we're trying to establish from various passages the arena in which much of Bible history and much of Bible prophecy in Old Testament times has been acted out, with the unspoken, to this point, suggestion that this may have relevance to the New Testament. We're now going to talk about some key words. We're going to talk about earth and heaven. Page 22. And we still need to move quickly. I'd love to have time for questions, and maybe we can fit that in on a private basis, or we can find some time later on to deal with questions here, but not today, because we need to look at a few more things. Page 22. One of the key words, possibly, in the book of Revelation. The Greek word ge may signify either earth, that is, the globe as a whole, all the world, or it may signify land, that is, a specific portion, a restricted portion of the whole, a special country or territory. The question is, which does it refer to in the book of Revelation? As such, the word ge in the Greek reproduces the same ambiguity that is found in the Hebrew word eretz, which can mean the globe in a broader sense in the Hebrew in the phrase eretz Israel, the land of Israel. In Revelation, does the word ge or ge, used about 80 times, mean the whole world, or does it mean some specific land? While the Apocalypse surely speaks of events that ultimately have a great impact on the whole world, I said of, but I really meant on the whole world, we're suggesting that much of its action takes place in the more restricted arena of the Middle East. As stated above, a land where Israel confronts 10 kings today, that basic land that was promised to Abraham and his seed from the beginning. If this suggestion can in any way be demonstrated or verified, it has serious implications in how we can read, or how we should read, the book of Revelation. Obviously, a number of occurrences of ge in Revelation are ambiguous on this point, or offer no evidence in the immediate context by which we can determine the territory involved. But some passages do, and those are listed on pages 22 and 23. Just follow a couple of these. Revelation chapter 7, verses 1 and 2, there at the bottom of page 22.
After these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth until certain ones had been sealed. We talked about that a bit earlier. Those who were sealed initially were out of the 12 tribes of Israel. That's interesting. This is also a quotation. Remember how Revelation draws upon the Old Testament. A direct quotation from Ezekiel chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. Let's read that quickly. Ezekiel chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Also thou son of man, thus saith the Lord God unto the land of Israel. An end. The end is come upon the four corners of the land. Here, reproduced in the New Testament in translation, the four corners of the earth. Does it mean the globe as a whole? Does the globe as a whole have four corners? Or does it mean a restricted area that has been important in Bible times all along? Jump forward to chapter 20, which is mentioned there and quoted in part on page 23. And once again, there is a reference there, this is in a later time, presumably, to the four quarters of the earth. And shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog. Interesting when you put this together with Ezekiel 38 and 39 and look at the map that you have there, that the land of Israel, or the expanded land of Israel, has in fact four corners. Let's look at just the first map here. Genesis 15, verses 18 through 21 illustrated, and we know what those verses said. Then we impose upon that what we know about Gog and Magog and their allies in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Now, there may be some question here when we're talking about Gog and Magog, whether it's in Turkey or whether it's a bit further north. But again, that's irrelevant to the point that we're making here. The allies of Gog and Magog include, on the eastern corner of the land, Persia. That's from Ezekiel 38. On the southern corner of the land, Ethiopia. On the western corner of the land, Libya. And on the north, several others. On the four corners of the land, there are the enemies of Israel. And Ezekiel 38 and 39 is telling us that plainly. Four corners of the land. And the four corners of the land help to define, biblically, the limits of that land in which certain events are being acted out. The land that is basically a land of Israel and 10 kings or 10 nations. Maybe, as I said, we could draw the border a bit further to the south, but we're generally in the same area no matter where we draw the precise borders. Chapter 14 and verse 15 there on page 23. And another angel came out of the temple crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, Thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And the subsequent treading of the winepress caused blood to flow for 1,600 stadia, or furlongs, I think it is, in some translations, which is approximately 200 miles. 200 miles is approximately the distance we were just dealing with that has to do with the land of Israel. From the far northern point to the far southern point of the land of Israel is approximately 200 miles. Coincidence? Symbolism? Or is there some reality here? Over to page 24. Some of the characters that are found in the book of Revelation, some of the main characters, are the kings of the earth. And that's that word, geth, that occurs something like 80 times in the book. Another set of passages in Revelation link this word earth or land with certain kings. Who are these kings of the earth or land? Are they all kings of the world? Or are they perhaps some subset thereof? If we use Scripture to determine their identity, then we will have a good idea as to the limits, if there are any, of that particular ge, or eretz, in which the events of Revelation are played out. And several passages there, when we go back to the Old Testament context, suggest very much that the kings of the earth, relating Old Testament passage, quotation to New Testament, where it is quoted, the kings of the earth are those very kings that encircled Israel and sought to destroy Israel. Maybe the best example of that, and I have to pick my examples here because we can't look at each one, is Revelation 21, verses 23 through 26. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof, and the nations of them which have now been saved, presumably, shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it, and the gates of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it. This is the most decisive in offering identification for who the kings of the land are. These verses are an extended allusion to Isaiah 60. And there are quoted a number of verses. The Gentiles shall come to thy light, kings to the brightness of thy rising. They will bring gifts. The doors will not be shut. Point after point after point is a direct reference or allusion or quotation in Revelation 21. And if we go to, I'm not even going to look it up because I'd like to move forward, but if we go to Isaiah 60 and we say, who are these kings of the earth that bring their gifts into Jerusalem in the kingdom age, in that wonderful age when there is peace on the earth? And the nations that are listed in Isaiah 60, we could put that family tree up here once again. The nations that were listed there are Midian, Ephah, Sheba, Kedar, Nebaioth. All of the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Abraham that constitute today the Arab peoples. These are the kings of the earth bringing their glory, bringing their gifts into the renewed and revitalized Jerusalem. The 30 or so passages in the above surveys help, by their Old Testament context, to define and limit the ge, or earth, or land, which is intended in the Apocalypse. They strongly suggest that the other 50 or so occurrences might profitably be read and interpreted with the same limitation. And this word earth, or ge, or land, if we translate it, I would suggest more properly, are scattered all through the book of Revelation. Interesting point is that there are at least two other words that were commonly used in the Greek that could refer more explicitly to the whole globe, or at least a broader land than the land of promise. There are the words oikoumene, which has been sometimes translated the whole Roman habitable, or the broader inhabited world. That occurs only three times in the book, in very obscure passages, really, as compared to 80 usages of that word ge, which can mean land, a specific land. And the word cosmos, which means the order or arrangement of things, and can be a very broad word. But it occurs only three times, generally toward the end of the book, when we might expect that the conflict arising in the immediate land of Israel and her neighbors has now expanded to include the whole world, bringing the blessings of the kingdom to that. The second point that goes with earth is heaven. Remember, we said that earth could mean, in certain situations, a restricted land that had to do, I'm suggesting, with Israel and her immediate neighbors. What can heaven mean? A clue is to be found in Isaiah 65, where God says, I create new heavens and a new earth. And then in the very next verse, verse 18, he says, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy. So heavens and earth become, by parallelism that we're familiar with in Hebrew poetry, Jerusalem, God's heavenly place on the earth, and then all of the land round about it, and the people on that land who owe their allegiance and bring their worship to the city of Jerusalem. Number of Bible passages here on page 25. Heaven, literally in Hebrew and Greek, that which is lifted up, doesn't necessarily have to mean something that is hanging way up there in the sky above the earth. It can mean a heavenly place on the earth. And what makes a place on the earth heavenly? The presence and the glory of God. A number of Bible passages in the Old Testament suggest that this is true, or at least this is a possibility. In 1 Kings 8, Solomon is dedicating the temple, and time after time after time, he prays to God in heaven, but he's obviously facing directly toward the most holy place, and he sees that as the heavenly place where the glory of God is. And sometimes he prays toward heaven, and sometimes he says he prays toward this place where God, the God of heaven, is dwelling. So the two are used almost interchangeably. In 2 Chronicles 7, verses 1 and 2, when Solomon had made an end of praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the offerings. And we compare it with the parallel passage, Leviticus 9:24, there came a fire out from before the Lord. 2 Chronicles 6, verses 20 and 21 tell us that your eyes may be open upon this house day and night, upon the place whereof thou hast said that thou wouldst put thy name there. And that's the key point. When God selects a place and he says, I'm going to put my name there, in a sense that place becomes heaven on the earth. And the one primary candidate for that place is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the heavenly place. It is the place where God's glory has dwelt in time past. It is the place where God's glory will dwell in the future. A number of the Psalms speak about Psalm 11. The Lord is in His holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. Almost as if to say the holy temple and heaven become one and the same. Or to put it another way, Jerusalem and the holy place and the Temple Mount become heaven on earth. Psalm 20. May God send us help from the sanctuary and strengthen us out of Zion. May He hear us from His holy heaven. As though the holy heaven and His sanctuary and Zion are one and the same. A few quick passages from Ezekiel, sort of demonstrating this theme. It's a theme that has New Testament implications. In Ezekiel chapters 9 and 10 and 11, Ezekiel sees the glory of God leaving the most holy place because the people were wicked. The city was about to be destroyed. The temple was about to be leveled. And God's glory could no longer stay there. It was no longer His house and He was leaving. And the glory of God goes and stands on the threshold of the house. Then it moves from the threshold of the house to the door of the east gate. And finally the glory of the Lord goes up from the midst of the city and stood upon the mountain, which is on the east side of the city. And at the end, after judgments have been visited upon various nations for their hatred and their destruction of Israel and Jerusalem, the glory of God returns from the very same place, the Mount of Olives. And Ezekiel sees it in vision coming from the east. This is Ezekiel 43, verses 2 through 5. And entering the temple by the gate, which is facing toward the east. And the Spirit and the glory of the Lord filled the whole house. Ezekiel is about the glory of God, and it's about the glory of God centered in Jerusalem. It is there for a while. It leaves. The people of Israel suffer, and one day it comes back again. Obvious connections between that and Zechariah 14, verse 4. At a time of great trouble, the Lord of hosts will stand upon the Mount of Olives, and He will then save His city and enter into the city. In Acts chapter 1, ye men of Galilee, standing on the Mount of Olives, why are you standing gazing up into heaven? The same Jesus who has gone up from you into heaven will so return in like manner as you have seen Him go. The glory of God coming back to His special holy place. Quite a number of Bible prophecies in the Old Testament suggest that the controversy of the last days between Israel and the Arabs will revolve around the Temple Mount and the Jewish holy place today. And there they are. Again, I'm sorry, we won't read all of them. Several of them are interesting, though, and we'll just pick out bits and pieces. Some of these we're familiar with the context. Psalm 79 talks about the heathen have come into God's inheritance. They have trampled down His holy temple. Psalm 79 is quoted in Revelation 11, suggesting that the holy temple referred to and the holy city referred to in Revelation 11 is Jerusalem. I would say more than suggesting. I would say providing serious evidence for that point. Psalm 83 suggests that one of the reasons that these 10 nations are confederated together against the people of Israel is they are fighting about the houses of God, the place where God dwells. They're fighting about the heavenly place. The kings of the land, the kings of the earth, are fighting about who controls the heavenly place, Jerusalem. If that sounds like what you've been reading in the news for the last week or two, if that sounds like what was happening last October when Jews and Arabs were fighting on the Temple Mount, then maybe we're seeing the beginnings and the stirrings of the fulfillment of these prophecies. Ezekiel 25, remember we saw about the glory of God leaving the city and coming back to the city at the beginning and the end of the prophecy. In Ezekiel 25, say unto the Ammonites, thus saith the Lord God, because you have said, aha! Against my sanctuary. That was what they were fighting about. If these prophecies have meaning in the last days, that's what they will fight about again. Ezekiel 36, thus saith the Lord God, because the enemy, the context says Edom, the nation of Edom, because they have said against you, aha, even the ancient high places are now ours in possession. Obadiah is a prophecy against Edom. And it says, the enemy has entered into the gates. He has cast lots upon Jerusalem. I'm reading only the underlying passages. He has entered into the gates of my people. He has come up upon my holy mountain. But God says, once again, my mountain is going to be holy. And no more will these uncircumcised Gentiles, these evil men and their nations, no more will they come into my sanctuary. I'm going to cleanse my sanctuary. It sounds very much like there's going to be a war over the holy place, or a war having to do with the heavenly place. Joel and Zechariah follow the pattern very much. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, prepare war. We talked about that the other day. A holy war is the sense of that. And it is a holy war against the God who has dwelt in Zion on His holy mountain. And the result of that war will be that Jerusalem will be holy forever and ever, and no strangers will pass through her anymore. I would like just three or four more minutes, if we can do that. Zechariah 14, the same general point. A battle fought against Jerusalem, and the result is that even in Jerusalem, and especially in Jerusalem, there will be holiness to the Lord of hosts, and the last verse of Zechariah, no more will there be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. I'm going to come close to finishing if you give me two or three minutes, and we'll take the rest tomorrow. I'm going to do Brother Tony's trick of giving you a half dozen overheads very quickly. From the Newsweek magazine of about a year ago, discussions about the prospects of Jews wanting to rebuild their temple. And of course, this brings them into direct conflict with the Arab peoples and the Dome of the Rock. Great plans have been made. This is actually that little miniature temple that's there in the grounds of one of the hotels in Jerusalem. Plans have been made for the rebuilding of that temple. Now, whether or not they can get the authorities to agree with this, that's another matter, but anything is possible. Eager to preserve peace, Israel continues to allow Muslims to administer the site of the Temple Mount. They permit no Jew or Christian to pray openly on the holy ground, nor will they consider allowing even the simplest synagogue or church. The merest hint of rebuilding the temple is considered an outrage. Several small organizations in Jerusalem believe the question is settled, the question of whether or not there should be a temple. They are zealously making preparations for the new temple in spite of the doctrinal obstacles and the certainty of arousing the antagonism of the Arab peoples. And this is a continuation of the article showing some of the dress of the high priest that is being prepared and some of the utensils and the musical instruments that are trying to be made according to the specifications of the Old Testament. These people are serious. Whether or not they will achieve it and to what degree remains to be seen. But this is the sort of thing that could be the spark that could set off a conflict, not just in the Middle East as a whole, but a conflict especially having to do with Jerusalem. These were articles from last October. The Temple Mount, the battle for the Temple Mount, old wounds reopened. And it talks about how Jerusalem is on the verge of becoming a city of conflict like Beirut, where two peoples can no longer exist together, and they're fighting about that same little piece of land. That same little piece of land which God has said is my holy place, and I will dwell there, and it will be my land. The battle for Jerusalem, and there's an extract from it, a campaign of sabotage and rioting and terror by which both the Arabs on the one hand and the Jews on the other are trying to assert their control of this little piece of land, this little city, East Jerusalem. Zechariah 12 is the passage that talks about Jerusalem will be a burdensome stone to all people, and the peoples of the land will fight about it. Zechariah 12, once again, Jerusalem the burdensome stone. Three gentlemen there fighting about the same little piece of land. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And all of them are saying, mine, 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 yelling at the top of their lungs. The interesting point of the cartoon is they're all pointing at a mine that could explode under their feet. And this is the last overhead. taken from a newspaper just a few days ago. I think just the last day before I got on the plane. Shamir stresses that talks are out if the PLO is in. And it goes on to say, according to Shamir, the Prime Minister of Israel, if peace talks could include Palestinians from Arab East Jerusalem, ask if peace talks could include Palestinians from Arab East Jerusalem, Shamir said, under no circumstances. East Jerusalem, the old city, is in the Jewish mind of the mind of the Israeli government, not negotiable. Israel considers all of Jerusalem to be its unified capital and does not want to open the door to negotiating away its sovereignty over the city that is holy to Christians, Jews, and Muslims. Now, I didn't get quite to where I wanted to, but I want to finish on that. Finish up with that briefly tomorrow. But let me just summarize: Earth and heaven, not necessarily the whole globe, not necessarily some place way up in the sky, but sometimes in biblical terms, the land, the extended land that was precious to Abraham, the land that is precious to the Jews, the land that is precious to us, and the heavenly place where God's glory will dwell one day. So when we come to the book of Revelation and we read heaven and earth, let's ask ourselves, does it mean way up there somewhere? Or does it mean something that is going to happen on the earth? Is there a heavenly place? Now, we don't have time today, but tomorrow for the first 5 or 10 minutes, maybe 15, the way these things go, I want to look at various passages in the book of Revelation that talk about heaven. And I want to ask, what is that heaven where a war is being fought? What is that heaven to which the saints are called to ascend to? Is it some place way beyond this earth? Or is it a special place on the earth? And if it is, it helps us perhaps to focus our minds on the very area and the very people or peoples that the book of Revelation, in its last days application, is telling us about.